So we're faced with an existential problem called this life. No one asked us if we wanted to be dumped into a body. Dumped. Put in a body. And then what actually happens is we spend most of our time and energy trying to survive. And not only us, but every being in life. We may not like coronavirus, but from another point of view, it's doing what we're doing, just trying to survive in the best way it can. So there's a teaching from the tradition called the Eight Worldly Winds. I like the teaching because it expresses the struggle for life as wind. Ruach is not really in our hands, it's just the way it is, which is we struggle for pleasure and not pain, for wanting things and not losing, for being accepted and not rejected, for being praised, or our ego supported and not blamed. And actually, talking about ego, we got one of those as well. And mostly what the ego does is part of the same thing, which is struggling to survive. The ego, the self, is a mechanism for survival, giving it endless problems. The ego thinks it's trying to help the body, but actually all it's doing is trying to help itself. And we experience this existential big catastrophe in the mind as a cacophony of noisy thoughts about how something should be better, how we need to be better, how something should be different, how we want this to happen and that not to happen. And the mind is constantly building structures to do with our survival. And the heart does the same thing. The heart builds narratives all the time. They tend to be running in background, and often it's more difficult for us to see them. But they are also narratives that are running the whole scene. And I have to say, since October, the longer this whole story of conflict, suffering, war, fragility, and unnecessary violence, the longer it carries on, the more there is background stories from the heart of feeling down, feeling lost, feeling lack of hope, feeling emptiness and confusion. And they're narratives that we wake up with in the morning and go to bed with at night. And I'll go back to that. Meditation practice is turning the gaze. Instead of staying with all the time this being busy with survival and coping with life, it's turning the gaze. Turn the gaze, the watch, the eyes, the awareness directly towards the mess. Turn towards the mess and take responsibility for it. And the way we do that is to develop the capacity to be a bigger container to hold all of this. It is not about shutting down those voices. It's not about censorship. I shouldn't think those thoughts from the war. It's not about that at all. But it is about being a bigger container to hold all of that stuff. And one way that we do this, especially in relation to meditation and vipassana and mindfulness, is to allow things to come up. Allowing is already giving permission. It's already kind. Instead of shutting things down, it's opening up. But watching that all experience has a very short shelf life. Chayei Madaf, Ma'od Katsar. Everything that we experience actually comes and goes. And it comes and goes because it's not actually ours. It's an experience that comes into the system and goes again. It feels like, oh, it's me, my thoughts, my issues, and so on. But that's the way that the self grabs it and says, that's me. But if we look at things carefully, they come and they go because they don't really belong to us in the first place. They come into the system and they go, like birds in the sky or clouds in the sky. Thoughts, feelings come from the world. We didn't say, now I want to feel this. Okay. No. Now I want to feel anger. Now I want to feel love. Well, we're trying to do it here. Not always so easy. The heart might have another agenda. A beautiful language of the Mahamudra, which is that everything liberates itself. Things free themselves because they don't actually belong to us in the first place. There isn't any other place for them except to come and to go. So we're searching so desperately for liberation, for freedom, for a deep freedom. But actually it's happening in front of our eyes because every single thing that arises in our experience liberates itself. Boop. So it's not just Mahamudra that says it, the Buddha says it, said it 1,000 times. It like bubbles, experience it like small bubbles after the rain, for example. So it's the heart aspect is that we are always being pushed and pulled. We experience push, pull, push, pull. Something we like, go towards. Something we don't like, we move back. We're always in that movement of going towards or away from, of wanting more or wanting to reject. Something nice, something unpleasant, something pleasant. And those are the voices that we are looking at together here. And it's really because we're not machines. We're living beings. And even vipassana, which we think of as a mind practice, mindfulness practice, it is full of heart. Only we don't kind of give it such a clear distinction. But for example, not fighting what comes up, allowing, so I gave a whole talk on that at the beginning of this retreat, allowing, welcoming what arises, which is fundamental to mindfulness, all the mindfulness teachers will go and use that language, that already has a lot of heart, because it's instead of fighting things, instead of suppressing, instead of saying this I'll have and this not, selecting, instead of judgment, a very classic to the Vipassana practice, the meditation practice, is non-judgment. We're allowing things to be what they are. That's already kind. So the heart is there right from the beginning. And it's not just our practice. It is fundamental as a way of life. I was thinking about my nearly 50 years engagement with traditional medicine or alternative medicine, natural medicine, since my time in India. And it's just so clear that there is a relationship with the body, symptoms that we don't like, that in the Western world, the language is fighting. Fight the symptom. Attack. Shut it down. Take a pill in order to close it as fast as possible. And the alternative, I don't want to go into all of this, but the alternative view, for example, Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, traditional medicine of all kinds, is to love and support the power of the body to heal itself. And to give encouragement, to give support to the body to heal its own, using its own power. It is quite relevant inside the Buddhist teaching, because the word that's used very often is to feed the good, to feed what is helpful, instead of fighting and attacking problems that give us suffering. The language of the tradition is to feed our freedom rather than to fight the non-freedom. And it's subtle, but it's very deep and a very beautiful way of looking, a respectful looking at the human being. So we allow, we give space to things. Issues come up in our daily life here and our daily practice. We give them space. We give them attention. And as I said, it's a gift. Attention is already a gift, is already matana. It's already going to. I am getting so many gifts right now. It's like my birthday. All of you guys are giving me all your attention. I feel filled with so much attention from you. It's lovely. I'm collecting all of this, these gifts. Matanot mi kolechad. A room full of people giving me gifts. So what I'm trying to say is that there's already in all authentic spiritual practice, there is kindness and compassion already there intuitively. When I was in Oxford many years ago, I went to see Mark Williams, I think his name is, a professor. He developed MBCT. MBCT is a very scientific-based, structured form of therapeutic mindfulness. It's based on protocols. It's very technical, with charts and reports and step by step and very specific. And I asked him, so where's compassion in all of this? And he said, nothing works without it. The whole thing doesn't work without compassion. And what he means is that right from the beginning, the first step of allowing and meeting our experience needs that compassion and love, I am ready. I meet the truth within me. I'm ready to be a container of my experience. And that's a radical shift. So non-fighting is already kind. Non-struggle is already kind. Beautiful line from William Blake, who said, if you kiss the joy as it flies, you are in eternity's sunrise. Kiss the joy as it flies. In other words, everything passes by, but we kiss it as it passes by. We are for it. We don't try and censor it. Kiss the joy as it flies by. Kiss the thought as it flies by. Kiss the feeling as it flies by. So what we do, whether it's the mind or the heart, in both cases, we expand the space to be able to be a bigger container for our experience. So we expand the container of our mind heart to be able to hold the whole lot. And it gives us a lot of power. Right in the middle of that is the power of chesed. You could say of love, of care, of attention, of awareness, of chesed. It's a good word because it's rather impersonal, chesed. It's also rather divine. It has a divine quality to it. Ashu kadosh. And if we think about it, if we look at it deeply, this movement of chesed, it is what will help us hold the dualities that we're experiencing in these days. It's chesed. We feel the pain and the tragedy that's going on all around us. But yet we have another side, which is we're having a beautiful lunch and we're sitting, meditating quietly, and we're having joyful moments in our life, I'm sure all of us, and then holding the pain and the lack of hope or the lack of positivity that many of us feel these days. But we can hold them both. We can hold our spiritual soul, and we can hold the tragedy of human existence if the container is big enough. It's chesed that does it. So what does it really? Well, I want to focus a bit more on this. What is it that the heart does in this? What's the movement of the heart? And I think the one word that, which is relevant also to the mindfulness and Vipassana practice, and certainly to the heart practice we're doing here, and the word is intimacy. And intimacy is the opposite of boundaries, of gvulot. So intimacy joins us to the world, joins us to things. And the gvulot, the boundaries, the resistance, the fear, separates us from things. And in both cases, whichever practice we practice, the heart practice or the mind practice, and they're not so different. But here in this retreat, we're giving more interest to the heart practice. But in both cases, we begin to see our similarity to other beings, our similarity, our intimacy with each other. Our intimacy, our similarity, in the English word affinity, that means we're the same. We're in the Kazet Tevat Noach together. and it's with the animals and the plants and the insects and the birds and the trees and each other and in our body the chaydakim, the hair and the hands and the feet, and we're all together. All beings want to be happy like us. All beings are affected by the eight worldly winds that I mentioned at the beginning. Every being wants to be happy and not to be miserable, wants to have and not to lose, wants to live and not to die. And we begin to feel our sameness. And there's an intimacy which is a really huge power in our life. It changes our life completely. It's one of the descriptions of enlightenment, which I mentioned in one of the groups. I think it comes from the Zen tradition. Enlightenment is intimacy with everything. And it takes us, it's similar to nirvana. The word nirvana, you may know, you may have met the word nirvana, or in Pali, nibbana. And it really means returning to the world. It's putting out the fire of individual burning with need and with wanting and with having and with the eight and surviving. And the fire, and we go back into the world. That's basically nirvana. It's going back into belonging to the world and having that point of view. What stops it is, again, the tendency for boundaries and attachments, where we get stuck. We get stuck on voices in the mind that tell us, you are like this, or I believe this, or this is my position and those who think against me are wrong, or getting stuck with mind states, getting stuck with tavaniot, with mental structures and narratives, getting stuck with me and what I need and the ego story and the ego boundaries, getting stuck with behaviors, with systems, with philosophies, with what the zek, you know, consumerism, big attachment, telephones, another big attachment. That's just one category of attachments. There's loads of them, but that's like behaviors and systems. Telephone is a good example. Getting stuck with neediness, ishtokokut, with what I want, what's missing, what has to happen, what I want to have and be. And it's just interesting. The Buddha's bowl is a symbol. He went to have lunch every day. But whatever arrived in the bowl was crucial, basic, no argument. And he died because of it. Because what came in his bowl when he was 80 years old was some food, bad food. And he said, it's more important for me to eat the bad food and die than to be selective. This yes, this no, this yes, this no. It's okay. Kids only very extreme. You don't have to do that. We won't get food like that tomorrow. But it's just irrelevant, just as a kind of example of how important it is to have how important it is to freedom, to our basic freedom, to have an attitude of not this yes, this no, this better, this not so good, this all the time, our busyness with that, which is attachment. And the problem with attachment is that they contract our consciousness. Our consciousness becomes contracted, mitkavetz. And then we look from that place at the world. What's the problem now? What's the problem now? What I need? What this one, yes, but this no, and this one, yes. And our whole life is, and then we die from that place. Totally busy with this and this and yes, this and this and no, and I want and I don't want, and this should be and this shouldn't be, and so on. Oop, finished. So the practice points us in the opposite direction completely. And it's very, very specific to the practice that we're doing here, which you may not really notice. But what tends to happen in the practice of metta, in the classical practice of metta, is we keep pushing the boundary. So it's easy for us to love our beautiful baby just born. But what about the baby of the neighbor that's crying day and night and doesn't let us sleep? It's easy for us to love close people, not always easy, but shall we say potentially easy. But as the boundary gets, as we move the boundary, it gets more problematic. Close ones, yes, those, no. These, yes, those, no. My people, yes, those people, no. You say, anim ircha kodmim? Yeah, that's an example. Yes, up to here, my love up to here, my care up to here, and we are pushing the boundary. This is exactly what we're doing in this retreat, starting with self, and then we bring an image of somebody else. Okay, we can go there. So far, it's not so difficult. Metiv, a person that we respect. A friend, easier. What about non-friend? What about... So I don't think anyone is going to ask you in this retreat to spend a whole day loving Netanyahu or, or whatever. But it's just worth remembering. We should do it, but shlav shlav. We should do it, but we don't have time here. If we were here for a few more days or weeks, we would get there. But it's good for you to know the process. It's good for you to understand what we're doing is to open the heart so that chesed, the fundamental definition of chesed, is that it's impersonal. It's the rain that falls on everybody, whoever they are, friend or enemy, the same rain falls on them. And that's the image of chesed. And in our heart, we need to go there. We need to go there. And what we're doing here is moving that boundary. Odd kutzat. And it's moving love from conditional love to unconditional love. Conditional love, ahava mutne, ahava bilti mutne. And I remember a story, because I was there with Marcia Rose donkeys years ago. How many years was it? Many. And I want to tell the story of Delida. So 30 years ago. But we were doing a metta retreat in Kibbutz Inbar with an American teacher, Marcia. And there was a woman, young woman with us there that was in an advanced stage of cancer. And she, everywhere she went, she had a cylinder of oxygen with her on a little agala that she had to carry with her, take with her. And she was sitting with a retreat with us. And one day, and I had many talks with her, and one day I talked to her and she was saying, this whole retreat is bringing up so much anger. It doesn't bring love. It brings me anger. Anger, why at the age of 30 and with children, I've got this disease that will finish me off soon. Why did this disease happen? I'm angry with the cancer, and I'm angry with my life, and I'm angry with the years I spent in a stupid job working for a bank, and I'm angry. But I knew that there was something coming, because I could see in her eyes a little, while she was saying this, I could see a little, because there's a light in the back of her eye, twinkle in the eye. I knew there was something coming. She said, I sat looking out over the mountains yesterday, and I had one moment of unconditional love. And that one moment has made my life for me. And it's a beautiful story, because that's exactly the place. It is so powerful, unconditional love. So it does things to our life which we don't necessarily expect. It's based on some really basic, simple sense of being for everything. One of the definitions of metta is enduring friendliness, to be friendly with everything. And I remember a lot of my practice in years past with metta, in some ways still today, is just going out into the nature. A tree, a leaf drops from a tree, be happy. A tiny insect walking across, be happy. My legs walking, feet, be happy. Ears, be happy. Tummy, after you eat the supper, tummy, be happy. It's everywhere. It's spreading the sense without, again, preference, adifuyot. And it... it changes our relationship to everything. And it changes our point of view. Because we begin to see that all life is struggling like us. Exactly like we're born in a body and having to kind of cope with that. So is every creature, and every ant and every animal is born in a body and struggling to cope. And that's why, by the way, in the Tibetan tradition, they don't talk so much about metta, they talk about compassion. Well, it's very similar. It's just compassion being aware of the struggle of life. Compassion is just sense of love, but with the awareness of the struggle of what it means to be alive. But it's very similar. And I think it's a skill. I think it's a wise way of living. It's a skill with which we live, to remember this and to live like that, and to because it's a truth. The walls are not true. They are constructions that we make because of our fear. But they're not true. Where's the walls in existence? They don't exist. There is no wall. There is no really Israel, Palestine, Britain, Germany, where it's in the mind. Where are walls in life? Where they don't exist. Everything is interconnected. Everything is interbeing. So there's it, when the love kind of shows you that, you find yourself living with truth, rather than living in the walls that are constructions in the mind. Which we need them. People often ask, well, so I shouldn't have boundaries if my annoying teenage child gives me hell. I'm not allowed to say no, that's my limit. Yeah, of course, it's all right. If we need a boundary, let's have it. It's okay. Often the psychologists don't like so much this part of the Dharma. Because there's another language there of respecting boundaries and so on. It's fine to have boundaries, but to know that they are convenient constructions as well, that sometimes we need them, but there'll be maybe a certain point when we don't need them anymore, and we have to know that, and we have to work towards that, not to make boundaries kadosh, sacred, but to say temporarily, I need a boundary here to look after myself. Fair enough, no problem. But know that it's a construction that is not really in existence, boundaries. There's a beautiful poem, I want to read a piece of it. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to look at bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, it is I you have been looking for, and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. It's a beautiful poem, and the key line for me is that kindness is telling us, it is I you've been looking for. It is I you've been looking for. The poem is written by Naomi Shihab Nia, and she's a Palestinian-American poet. So I know that some of the what I'm saying you might find challenging, because how's the world gonna deal with that with me? Isn't the world gonna give me back makot? I smile and I get makah back. It's not quite true. If you smile at the world, very, very often the world will smile back at you. But not always, and there's no guarantee. And the world may not, because you're not in charge. And indeed, as Buddhists, as Buddhist practitioners, I'm sure all of you have had the experience, and probably will have the experience of people telling you, come on, you guys, get real. You're not in a real world. The real world is wars and fighting and struggle, and get real. The world is conflict. What you do with those voices depends on your skill and your qualities of relationship. But I hardly ever met anybody that says that they want to go back to ignorance. Even if the world tells you get real, you're not in the real world. But I hardly met anybody that says, I want to go back to a world of fear and conflict. A talk I gave earlier in the retreat, I just want to mention something about it again, because maybe it was too soon to because now you're in this sort of different place. But I talked a lot about resistance and surrender. And the practice we're doing here is to meet resistance. And it's absolutely fine. And in the groups that have come up, and people say, look, we talk a lot about love, but my heart is so angry, and I'm so this, and I'm fed up, and I'm... It's fine. It's the heart resisting. The heart needs to express itself. We progress with resistance. We meet resistance and push the boundary. It's a bit like walking. You can't walk without friction. Otherwise, you're just like achla kerach, sliding. we walk because there's friction with the earth, and then we can move forward. So we keep meeting resistance and overcoming it, and that's the way. And it's whether it's in meeting attachments in the mind, whether it's mindfulness practice, or we meet our patterns and we let them go and we see that they go by themselves, they're self-liberating. It's still meeting resistance, we move on. But if we kind of feel the benefit that we get from falling in love with the world, if we begin to feel the benefit that something happens when we fall in love with the world, things look different for us, our life is different, we hear the voices of everything, the tree is talking to us, we feel the belonging to everything, everything is talking, everything is connecting, we feel connected, we feel in harmony, we feel like the word Simi used, ecology, the ecology of the consciousness, which is everything kind of in harmony together, is fitting together. So from that place, it is fundamentally, kindness is a way of being in the world. It's not just a practice, and it's good to remember it. It's a way of living. It's a way of life. It's a way in which we know ourselves and the world. It's interesting, in the Tanakh, the word yeda, yeda is knowing and loving, same. And there's something holy about it, something kadosh. And that's in the language of the Brahma Viharas. They're called temples, Brahma Viharas, the palaces of the gods, because it really has that quality of something sacred. Okay, thank you. So we'll take a couple of minutes of quiet.